Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Governments must invest strategically in building safe drinking water systems for the future, not only by increasing funding if the world's to achieve the goal of universal access. That's the main message from Monday's State of the World's Drinking Water Report, issued by the World Health Organization, UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and the World Bank. It notes that over 2 billion people have gained access to safe drinking water in the past two decades. But that progress is fragile and unequal, with a quarter of the world simply left behind, while climate change increases the frequency and intensity of droughts and floods. Meanwhile, rapid urbanization is increasing the strain on cities' ability to deliver water to the millions living in informal settlements and slums. The spread of cholera across Syria and Lebanon in recent weeks is alarming, and the risks of it expanding across the whole Middle East call for a scale-up of immediate action, said UNICEF on Monday. Regional Director Bertrand Banvel said in a statement that in Syria there are more than 20,000 cases with acute watery diarrhea and 75 cholera-associated deaths. In Lebanon, confirmed cholera cases reached 448 in just 2 weeks, with 10 associated deaths. Some other neighboring countries are already affected with high levels of acute watery diarrhea, he said, which only adds to children's existing struggles. Malnourished children are more vulnerable, and the outbreak's yet another blow to already overstretched health systems in the region. He said UNICEF urgently needs around $40.5 million to expand its response in Lebanon and Syria alone. And finally, the UN African Union and regional development body IGAD's trilateral support group for Sudan has expressed its deep sadness at the killing of a young protester in the capital Khartoum on Sunday. Issa Omer al-Bahi is the latest civilian to die in what's become an increasingly violent and unstable situation since the military takeover of the former power-sharing administration exactly a year ago. The trilateral mechanism called for a credible investigation into the death to ensure perpetrators are held accountable. It said the killing, coupled with tragic episodes of violence unfolding in the Blue Nile and West Kordofan, which has so far reportedly claimed over 200 lives, are stark reminders of the urgent need for a political solution to end the current impasse. The group said a legitimate civilian government had to be put in place that would restore security and the constitution, protect civilians, and bring justice for the victims and their families. Matt Wells, UN News.
Well, listeners, we have a great lineup today. Coming up next is Counterspin, the latest Counterspin, which, really was taped several days ago. But, you get it here. This can't be happening. It's from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And then we'll have today's latest headlines from Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! That will follow that. We're trying to see if John Grant, he's on remote hookup. He is attending a movie, a premiere in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, of a movie that was partly produced by Dave Lindorf also. This can't be happening. We don't know if we're going to be able to hook up during the second hour with him, but we might be able to get over the phone of the debut premiere, the local premiere of the movie, A Compassionate Spy, by, as I said, co-produced by Dave Lindorf. So bear with us. We'll see if we can get that live hookup. Until then, here's the latest Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, this is a big picture election, this midterm. It's not just about the laws and policies and priorities governing our lives, not merely about whether we can control our own bodies or the environment has a future, the possibility of racial justice, or whether you can make rent with a full-time job. It's about all of that, plus how we're positioned to fight for the system that's supposed to give each of us a say in those decisions. Okay, but here are the elite media headlines. Did Democrats peak too early before the midterm elections? Signs suggest they may have. Will inflation boost Republicans' chances in the midterm elections? With midterms looming, Biden isn't attending big campaign rallies. What's happening here? What's not happening here? Fair always says that news media work in election season should be judged not by how reporters treat Democrats or Republicans, but about how they inform and engage the public, including vast numbers of people who don't even vote because they can't or because they don't see the connection between pulling that lever and their day-to-day life. Is it too much to see it as journalism's job to make those connections and to err on the side of reflecting public needs to politicians rather than presenting politicians as celebrities for people to muse about from a distance? Counterspin talked about midterm election coverage with Fair editor Jim Narikas and Fair managing editor Julie Holler. That's coming up on today's show. But first, a quick look back at some recent press. Outlets like the Washington Post are encouraging what that editorial board referred to as a swift and muscular U.S.-led intervention in Haiti. And while other media are now reporting qualms about the wisdom, there's no evidence of challenge to the idea of the U.S. right to go in ways as yet undetermined. Haiti is not an arena, geographical or ideological, in which U.S. media are inclined to wake their ideas up, and the ease with which reporters reach for old tropes reminded me of a conversation we had with activist Bill Fletcher after the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, in which he said, well, this.
Well, one of the reasons I think that this is critically important to look at history is that there's the problem in the absence of history is that people tend to then look at Haiti as a basket case. They look at it as pathetic, as opposed to understanding that Haiti today is a direct result of the policies of the United States and France that go back to when Haiti achieved independence from France in 1804. I mean, if you don't get that, if you don't understand that the United States blockaded Haiti until 1862, that the French demanded that the Haitians pay reparations to France for the loss of the slaves as a result of the Haitian Revolution from the 1820s until 1947, if you don't get that the United States occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, if you don't get that the United States backed systematically repressive regimes in Haiti, the most notorious being Papa-Doc Duvalier, if you don't get that the United States was directly implicated in overthrowing President Aristide in 1991, you can't understand how Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and one of the poorest on the planet.
That was Bill Fletcher reminding us of the contested, violent, unresolved life behind that poorest country in the hemisphere, basket case, hellhole language that we can expect to hear tossed around untethered in coming days. As media breezily discuss the best way for others to determine the future of Haiti's people, remember, for example, how Newsweek's Fareed Zakaria described Haiti in 2008 as a place where, quote, the United States has attempted to foster democracy on and off for almost a century with almost no success, close quote. Or New York Times chin stroker David Brooks, who tried to answer the question of why Haiti is so poor with reference to child rearing practices that he claimed often involve neglect in the early years. That piece explained that when it comes to places like Haiti, quote, the programs that really work involve intrusive paternalism, close quote. Or the Washington Post's Ann Applebaum, who started her post-2010 earthquake column on Haiti with a bit about how painful it was for her to look at photographs of devastation. And it wound up, as Amy Wilentz noted at The Nation, faulting Haiti's public institutions for the collapse of buildings, including the presidential palace, which was built by Marines during the U.S. occupation of Haiti from 1915 to 1934. Elite U.S. media love to write stories with headlines like, "There is no hope. Crisis pushes Haiti to brink of collapse." As you read those stories, ask yourself who they're listening to and what exactly those people are hoping for. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Independent, challenging, far-ranging, and fearless coverage of elections and the electoral process is one of journalists' core jobs at the best of times. And these are not the best of times. Issues in the upcoming midterm elections go as deep as the election process itself, with some Republican candidates suggesting that they won't accept results that don't go their way. And that's along with the deep and disturbing threats posed by a Republican-controlled Congress. Add to that the fact that the corporate media, source, unfortunately, of some of the most impactful journalism in this country, are themselves throttled by the same kinds of power players that call shots at both political parties, namely profit-driven corporations. Joining us now to talk about elite media's midterm election coverage, we have FAIR's editor, Jim Narikas, in studio, and FAIR's managing editor, Julie Holler, joining us by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome, the both of you, back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Janine.
So many questions, so many problems at so many levels. Let's just start with the reality that we have Republicans who are off the chain nightmarish. They want bad, inhumane things, and they want to use institution-destroying processes to get them. And then we have Democrats who are not just ineffectually countering that, but who are, many of them, up to the same stuff, beholden to the same status quo-supporting, change-squashing actors. So that's the reality. And Jim, it fits poorly. That reality fits poorly into corporate news media's standard election template, which is Republicans versus Democrats. They're so different, and can't we find a happy medium? Now, I'm not saying that media have never talked about the GOP's anti-democracy or that they've never talked about donor power in both parties. But when it comes to elections, it just seems that they're still mainly using a template that was always inadequate and now seems like completely beside the point.
Yeah, I liken it to trying to report on geography without acknowledging that the world is round. You know, if you wanted to have geography coverage that would not turn off flat earthers. So you sort of describe Australia as being on the other side of the world, according to some people, because you don't want to turn off the part of your audience that subscribes to the flat earth theory. And we really do have a political party that is dominated by a flat earth theory, that the 2020 election was stolen, that Donald Trump really won, and that the electoral process should be rejiggered so that the people who they believe win elections should be declared the winners of elections and not the people who actually get the most votes. And that is, you know, literally the end of democracy, to have that political philosophy put into power. And how you have political coverage that treats that party as, you know, one side of a debate. You really can't do it and be coherent in any way. You're misleading the public if you act like that philosophy is compatible with democracy. But that's what they're doing.
The way that they end up then covering this stuff is always as a bank shot. So I was looking at some recent covers in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago had this headline that was something along the lines of Democrats are shifting to a darker, more apocalyptic midterm message, how the Democrats are shifting to talk about the dangers to democracy. This is coming off of the Biden speech about the MAGA threat and everything. And the framing of the story is this is a messaging shift. What are the pros and the cons? What do the strategists think? And it's so detached from the real world implications of it that it just hurts your brain. I mean, the piece is pretty long, and the reporter does spend a paragraph or two acknowledging that most GOP candidates won't commit to accepting election results, that the party is actively attacking abortion rights. But then, you know, the real focus of the story is this really detached strategy, which is what election coverage, FAIR's been covering election coverage for many years. And this is always focus on strategy, focus on the horse race, focus on the messaging, and so little focus on the policy implications. And it's always a problem, but it's extra problematic when the implications are the end of democracy. The New York Times yesterday on the front page, they had this, they were reporting on a poll that they'd just done. And their headline was, most voters say democracy under threat, but few feel urgency. It was like total victim blaming. They were putting on this poll where they asked people about whether they thought democracy was under threat, and most people said yes. But then they also, there was another part of the poll that asked what the top priority was for the election, like a top issue. And more people said something related to the economy, like economy, inflation, things like that, than said democracy. So the Times called people apathetic for not putting it as their top priority. But first of all, for a lot of people, the economy right now is, it's more immediately felt, right? You know, the threat to democracy is something that feels a bit more in the future, whereas economic threats feel more immediate. But I think it's also really important that we point out that the media bear no small responsibility for how people prioritize things in elections. You know, what is important? Well, if the media are just telling you, like, well, Democrats say that there's a threat to democracy and Republicans say there's a different kind of threat to democracy from Democrats. You know, it's like this is media completely falling down on their responsibility to give people the information that they need to make informed choices about democracy.
Absolutely. Jim?
The media are so unwilling to accept responsibility for the fact that their job is to inform the public about the broader trends in society, the things that you can't observe just by talking to your neighbors or looking out your front door. You rely on media outlets to gather information about what's happening and tell you about them. And they are so often distorting the picture of reality. I think crime is a great example. You always see stories about the midterm politics saying that Republicans are going to tie Democrats to the high crime rate. Unquestioned assumption there is that there is now a high crime rate. The fact is that crime went down last year, according to FBI statistics. We're not in a crime wave. The crime is ebbing. And historically, crime is at about half the rate that it was in 1991, which I don't think people look back on as a road warrior-like post-apocalyptic landscape. And we're historically, we are seeing relatively low crime rates. But because Republicans would like to tie Democrats to high crime rate, that is what the media are describing the crime rates being. And once that frame has been put into place, it's very hard to get out of it.
And crime is also, it's very clickbaity, right? Especially you get like in the New York City tabloid news, it's just constant crime coverage, very easy for them to report on, just like reporting the police blotter. And something that caught my attention a few weeks ago was this prison strike in Alabama, which probably not that many Counterspin listeners will have heard about because it got so little coverage in national media. But this prison strike went on for 3 weeks. It just ended, I think, yesterday, which would be Tuesday, the 18th, I believe. Alabama, I mean, when you look into this story, it's just, it's mind-boggling. Alabama was sued by the DOJ, actually under Trump, for having unconstitutionally inhumane conditions in their entire state prison system. The DOJ brought a lawsuit against them because they were not changing. They had already been informed that this was unconstitutional. They weren't changing it. They were sued. They still haven't done anything. And prisoners actually went on strike for 3 weeks, a work stoppage. They don't get paid to work. But they stopped work for 3 weeks. There was just virtually no media coverage of this. And I bring this up because Jim's talking about crime, and you think about the impact of the criminal justice system on the lives of people in this country. It's immense. And you never hear stories about this. You know, you get a one-off here and there. The Times actually reported on the DOJ lawsuit a few years ago, and then you didn't hear from them again until there's a strike. You know, they report on it at the beginning of the strike. You don't hear any follow-up on it. And I just try to imagine what kind of midterm coverage we would have in a media system where mass incarceration were treated as a problem anywhere near as urgent as these imaginary crime waves that the media are hyping. And think about the kinds of policy conversations that we could have and the kinds of politicians who could actually have a shot at winning. I feel like our democratic possibilities are really constrained by the media narratives, the stories that media tell us about ourselves, the people that media talk to tell us these stories about ourselves. And specifically, you know, when we start talking about elections, what kind of policy conversations we can have.
Well, that's absolutely what I was moving towards, Julie, because, you know, we have a journalism that says that when it comes to elections, the job is to say what politicians are saying and maybe their strategy for saying it. But the coverage is candidate A versus candidate B. And if they don't mention something, well, then we're not going to talk about it, right? Because neither of the big party candidates mentioned it. And I feel like we've come to expect that for election coverage. And as you're just pointing out, it's such a narrow definition of what this opportunity for reporting could look like in terms of what we talk about. And, you know, Matt Gaetz from Media Matters was just pointing out that, you know, Republicans have this not at all veiled plan to gut Social Security and Medicare if they win Congress. This is something that people care deeply about that affects virtually everyone in the country. This is an important story, but if candidates don't talk about it, then reporters aren't going to talk about it because it didn't come out of a candidate's mouth. And it's such a narrow understanding of what electoral politics mean and the opportunity for journalism that's offered by elections.
There are huge issues that are going undiscussed for the most part in the campaign and in the campaign coverage, things that affect everybody vitally, but neither party sees them as like political winners, and therefore they don't get talked about. The COVID pandemic is one such issue. Neither party is making it a big part of their campaign, despite the fact that this is an ongoing pandemic that has killed 1 million Americans, continues to kill Americans, shows no sign of going away, and there's neither a strategy being advanced by the party in power or a strategy suggested by the opposition party to deal with this. It's just not being talked about. Another issue that is getting weirdly little discussion in the campaign journalism is the Ukraine war, which the United States is putting vast resources into this. It's basically a proxy war with the other major nuclear superpower on Earth, with the possibility of nuclear war being discussed in kind of bizarrely casual terms in the foreign policy opinion press. What are we doing to prevent nuclear war from happening? That's not an issue that either party is really focusing on.
Well, I wanted to say that I think listeners understand that there are always issues in play in an election, but at this point, we're not talking about just issues, as life-changing as they may be. We're talking about the process itself. We're talking about whether or not it matters when you go to vote, whether you have some say in how politicians treat your bodily autonomy, whether you have some say in how politicians vote on a possibility of nuclear war or the use of, I think it's now $16 billion or something that the White House has spent on the Ukraine war, whether or not we have a process that allows us to have a say in what's being done in our name. That's what's on the ballot.
There's a lot of talk about the January 6th insurrection. It's important to keep in mind what was going on there. That was an attempt to stop the House from certifying the 2020 presidential election. We are now going to be choosing the House of Representatives that will preside over the 2024 presidential election. And the Republican ideology now is that the Republican Party should have blocked the certification of the 2020 election and declared victory for Donald Trump because of a sort of faith-based understanding that he was the rightful president and should have been named so. So that is what we're putting the pieces in place for that to be relitigated in 2024. And that is, I would say, the most important thing at stake in the 2022 midterms.
And when you think about January 6th, and you think about the way that when we were covering the coverage at the time, there was this sense like, wow, media are finally getting a little bit of a spine. And they're finally starting to call a spade, and they're finally starting to really, you know, call out lies and things like that. And I think what you're seeing, definitely seen in recent months, that reverting back to the both sides of them. And I think that really, you know, when Janine, you're asking this question of why, you think about what was happening in the Republican Party around January 6th, where there was a real schism, and there, you know, a lot of the leadership, you know, the non-Trump leadership was saying, this is not okay. We can't do this. And then the momentum swung back towards Trump, and that suddenly became the mainstream of the party. And once that became the mainstream of the party, then with corporate media's insistence on giving credence to reporting both sides, like the mainstream of the Democratic Party, the mainstream of the Republican Party, when the mainstream of the Republican Party became election denialists, it became virtually impossible for the media to continue to call them out forcefully in the way that they had just begun to do around January 6th.
Well, let me ask you about another aspect. There's so many things to keep your eyes on, and yet money is always one of them. There was a quote in The Guardian from Chi-Sun Lee from the Brennan Center, also, I would note, a long-ago Counterspin co-host. But Lee said that it does seem to be getting worse, that outside spending in this federal midterm cycle is more than double the last midterm cycle. Since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. And now we're seeing a troubling new trend that some of the mega donors are sponsoring campaigns that attack the fundamentals of democracy itself. There's just a way, you know, for both of you, that corporate media are just not going to talk about money and the influence of corporate money and power in elections. It's always like as if suddenly when we're talking about elections, it's the school board and the posters and marches and, you know, ballot boxes. And the idea that donors have power is a story, but it's a separate story.
You should always keep in mind when you're especially watching broadcast coverage or TV coverage of the elections that elections are a huge, huge profit center for TV news. The inflow of money to buy round-the-clock propaganda in support of one candidate or another, that money is going straight into the coffers of the corporations that own the TV news programs. And so they have no interest in turning that spigot off. It would be a financial disaster for them if there was some way found to keep mega donors from pouring money into the political process.
I would also like to point out that there are independent news outlets that are doing a really great job of digging up some of this information about the dark money donations, both within the Democratic and the Republican parties. The lever is one of them. That is one of the purposes of independent media. I mean, that should be the purpose of all media, of course, but that's one way in which independent media really do the job that media should be doing of following the money and holding power to account.
All right, then. We've been speaking with FAIR Managing Editor Julie Holler and FAIR Editor Jim Narikas. Thank you both for joining us this week on Counterspin.
It's been good talk.
It's always great to be here.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Coming up tomorrow on Weather on Wednesday here at Radio Free Kansas.
The National Weather Service reported the Springfield Twister was the biggest storm to pass through central Illinois in a decade.
The West Texas wildfires have scorched so much land that it's like watching more than half of Rhode Island burn.
Biggest one I've ever seen.
I love to drive. You could say I'm an autoholic. My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. I discovered sex in the back seat too. Made my own kid there. I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive around looking for something else. And if it's no good here, I go there. Too hot? We'll just go north into the hills. Too cold? Off south, just like the birds. Sometimes, I don't even know why I'm going. I'm just out there on the road, rambling around. I've just got to get out there and drive, maybe for a day or two. See some country, some trees. I need to see nature. I've worked in vehicles and slept in them, even lived in one. Can't count all the hours I've just waited somewhere with the motor running, for red light, for traffic to move, for somebody to come out, for anything. Who even hears the motor running there under your thoughts? Vibration is good, moves the blood around. We don't even smell these engines unless something's broken. I've driven them all. Motorcycles, three-wheelers, minis, SUVs, compacts, pickups, a limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. And the power. The roar. The jolt of energy, the thrill of speed. I've got this armored steel that can run away, or run over, or damn near fly. My ride talks for me, tells you who I am. Without it, I'd just be a naked little animal out there in the rain and snow, like a snail without a shell. Likely I wouldn't kill for fuel, but my taxes pay for soldiers who will, by God. Gotta have gas. And if by accident I had to run over some kid, heaven forbid, or some old fart, I may lose my license for a little while. But I'll keep driving. We all need to get around. Okay, The weather is getting really weird. You never know what might happen. If this place floods or burns, I'll toss my stuff in here and go somewhere better. I'm not walking around like a loser. Notice anybody else getting off the road? Not likely. On my dying day, when I go, it'll be sitting upright behind the wheel. Check out Radio EcoShock, the planet's only all-environment radio station at www.ecoshock.org.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah, I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years.
I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure you don't like it.
So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do. Midterms, primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there, but you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the United Kingdom, Rishi Sunak has been sworn in as Prime Minister, succeeding fellow Conservative Party member Liz Truss, who resigned her post after just 6 weeks on the job. Sunak was a supporter of Brexit, Britain's narrowly approved 2016 referendum on whether to exit the European Union. He comes from one of the nation's wealthiest families, with a net worth estimated at more than $800 million. He was the wealthiest member of the House of Commons. Sunak becomes Britain's first ever prime minister of color and third prime minister in 50 days after Boris Johnson resigned amidst a series of scandals. Rishi Sunak delivered his first address as prime minister from 10 Downing Street earlier today.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
Rishi Sunak was a Goldman Sachs banker. Across the UK, calls are growing for a general election. The leader of Scotland's National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, said Monday the turmoil in the Conservative or Tory party showed the need for greater Scottish independence.
It's going to be the fifth prime minister in the years that I've been first minister. Now, I'm only saying that to illustrate the instability and the uncertainty and the chaos that the Tories have unleashed on all of us. They have no mandate. And, you know, it is a democratic necessity that people get their say on who occupies number 10 Downing Street.
Representatives from Ethiopia's government and rebel forces in Tigray gathered in South Africa Monday for peace talks mediated by the African Union. The talks came as the United Nations warned the situation in Ethiopia is spiraling out of control, with reports of widespread atrocities, including airstrikes and artillery fire that have exacerbated a humanitarian catastrophe. Some estimates put the number of dead in Tigray at 800,000 since fighting erupted less than 2 years ago. The UN says the resulting health crisis now threatens 6 million people. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency says it will send inspectors to two Ukrainian nuclear sites after Russia claimed, without evidence, that Ukraine was preparing to deploy a radioactive device known as a dirty bomb against Russia. Ukraine has rejected the charge and plans to bring up the issue at the UN Security Council when it meets today. Meanwhile, Germany's president has arrived in Kyiv on his first visit to Ukraine since Russia invaded in February. President Frank-Walter Steinmeier's trip comes 2 days after Germany's ministers of defense and foreign affairs called for a dramatic boost in German and European Union aid to Ukraine's military. Here in the United States, A group of 30 progressive Congress members is calling on President Biden to pursue direct negotiations with Russia. In a letter sent Monday to President Biden, the 30 lawmakers, led by Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal, write, quote, "We urge you to pair the military and economic support the United States has provided to Ukraine with a proactive diplomatic push, redoubling efforts to seek a realistic framework for a ceasefire," unquote. The letter goes on to state, "The alternative to diplomacy is protracted war with both its attendant certainties and catastrophic and unknowable risks," unquote. A Russian court's hearing an appeal today by WNBA basketball star Brittany Griner, sentenced in August to 9 years in a Russian penal colony after she pleaded guilty to carrying a small amount of marijuana oil into Russia. A ruling is expected later Tuesday. Griner was arrested at the Moscow airport in February when customs officials found vape cartridges containing a small amount of cannabis oil in her luggage. In Missouri, a teenage gunman shot and killed a teacher and student at the Central Visual and Performing Arts High School in South St. Louis on Monday. Four other students were shot and wounded before the gunman was shot dead by police. Police identified him as a 19-year-old recent graduate of the school. He was armed with a long gun and more than a dozen 30-round magazines. Witnesses say many more people could have died if the gunman's gun had not jammed during the assault.
I was trying to run, and I couldn't run. Me and him made eye contact, and I'm glad I made it out because his gun got jammed. But we saw blood on the floor. I think somebody got shot.
In Michigan, a teenage gunman pleaded guilty on Monday to charges of first-degree murder and terrorism for a mass shooting at Oxford High School in a Detroit suburb last November. Ethan Crumbly was just 15 years old at the time of the attack, which killed four students and injured six other people. Crumbly may be called to testify against his parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, who face manslaughter charges for allegedly giving the gun used in the shooting to their son as an early Christmas present and for failing to intervene when their son showed clear signs of mental distress ahead of the massacre. In Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis faced off against Democratic challenger Charlie Crist Monday for their first and only debate ahead of November's election. DeSantis refused to say whether he would serve a full four-year term if reelected in November, adding to speculation he'll compete for the Republican Party's presidential nomination. Meanwhile, Charlie Crist blasted DeSantis over his anti-scientific views on gender, climate change, and the COVID-19 pandemic.
Ron, I wouldn't pat yourself on the back too much about your response to COVID. We've lost 82,000 of our fellow Floridians. And when you look at the Thanksgiving table, one of those empty seats is probably one of those people for many families watching tonight. And if we had only had the standard of other states in the United States, 40,000 of those people would still be alive, enough to fill Tropicana Stadium in St. Petersburg. That's tragic.
Charlie Crist served a four-year term as governor of Florida, beginning in 2007, when he was elected on the Republican ticket. He later switched party affiliations to become a Democrat. In Pennsylvania, Democrat John Fetterman and Republican Mehmet Oz are set to meet this evening for their first and only debate. We'll get the latest on the U.S. midterm elections later in the broadcast. The Supreme Court has put a temporary hold on a judge's order that would require South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to appear before a Georgia grand jury to answer questions about his efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. On Monday, Justice Clarence Thomas granted Senator Graham's emergency request to put the subpoena on hold temporarily while Graham's lawyers pushed to have it quashed permanently. Democrats have demanded Justice Thomas recuse himself from cases related to the 2020 election because his wife, Ginny Thomas, spread false claims about a stolen election and lobbied federal and state officials to overturn the election results. Supreme Court rules obligate justices to withdraw themselves from cases where there's even the appearance of a conflict of interest. In Minnesota, former Minneapolis police officer J. Alexander King accepted a deal Monday that will see him plead guilty to aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter in the killing of George Floyd in May 2020. In exchange, state prosecutors agreed to drop a murder charge against King, who faces a likely 42-month prison term at a future sentencing hearing. On Monday, another former officer, Tu Tao, waived his right to have a jury decide his fate and will instead have a judge weigh existing evidence against him in a stipulated bench trial. Tao and King are already serving federal prison terms after they were convicted of depriving George Floyd of his constitutional rights. In the West Bank, at least six Palestinians were killed and nearly two dozen others injured following raids by Israeli forces early Tuesday morning. Al Jazeera reports one of the victims, Qusay Al-Tamimi, was 19 years old and lived in the village of Nabi Saleh near the city of Ramallah. In related news, Amnesty International is calling on the International Criminal Court to investigate possible war crimes committed by Israel during its latest deadly assault on the Gaza Strip in August. Among those killed by Israeli forces were a four-year-old child and a teenager who was visiting her mother's grave, according to a new Amnesty report published Tuesday. Agnes Kayamard, Amnesty International Secretary General, said in a statement, quote, "Israel's latest offensive on Gaza lasted only 3 days, but that was ample time to unleash fresh trauma and destruction on the besieged population. The three deadly attacks we examined must be investigated as war crimes. All victims of unlawful attacks and their families deserve justice and reparations," Calamard said. In Iran, over 300 people have been indicted on criminal charges for participating in the massive protests that have rocked the streets of Tehran and other cities in Iran for more than a month. At least four of them were charged as enemies of God, an offense that can carry the death penalty, according to Iranian officials. Despite the brutal crackdown, demonstrations continue in Tehran, sparked by the September 16th death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini while in custody of the so-called morality police. On Monday, Iranian security forces fired tear gas at a girls' high school. A clash between school staff and students reportedly broke out after the school's principal insisted on checking the students' cell phones. In Bangladesh, at least 16 people are dead and some 10 million left without power after a cyclone triggered torrential rains, heavy winds, and flooding in the capital, Dhaka, and across other parts of the country. Cyclone Sitrang made landfall in the coastal regions of southern and southwestern Bangladesh late Monday, destroying homes and cutting off telecommunication lines. About a million people were evacuated. This comes as scientists warn climate change is likely making cyclones more intense and frequent. North and South Korea exchanged warning shots in waters off the west coast of the Korean Peninsula Monday after South Korea's military accused a North Korean merchant vessel of crossing a maritime boundary. The exchange of artillery fire came after South Korean forces joined the USS Ronald Reagan carrier battle group for U.S.-led war games of the Korean Peninsula. It follows a record pace of weapons tests carried out by North Korea this year. On Monday, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised a strong military response to what he said were plans by North Korea to carry out its first nuclear weapons test in more than 5 years.
Not only has it openly announced its intention to preemptively use nuclear weapons, it appears that preparations for a seventh nuclear test have already been completed. We will strengthen our deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities. Through the combined defense posture of South Korea and the United States, as well as security cooperation between South Korea, the United States, and Japan, so that our people can live their daily lives with confidence.
Back in the United States, public health experts are warning cases of respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, are skyrocketing among children, overwhelming hospitals nationwide as many are near or at capacity. RSV starts with mild cold symptoms, can lead to pneumonia and bronchiolitis, and very young children can be life-threatening in infants and young adults. And Penn State University canceled a speaking event Monday night with Gavin McGinnis, founder of the far-right group The Proud Boys, following massive backlash and student-led protests. The event was sponsored by the right-wing student organization Uncensored America and also featured right-wing Blaze TV host Alex Stein. Penn State officials accused peaceful protesters of obstruction and censorship, but then claimed to not support McGinnis and Stein's views. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, we look at China as Xi Jinping begins a historic third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party. We'll look at what five more years of Xi means for China and U.S.-China relations.
Checking in with John Grant, see where he's at. Once again, we won't be able to, we may not be able to get him. We may not be able to get John Grant on the phone today. The Philadelphia premiere of the movie A Compassionate Spy, which is co-produced with by Dave Lindorf, also, you know, head honcho at the Can't Be Happening News Writer Collective. A Compassionate Spy. It's a movie. Lindorf was involved in it deeply and wrote a fantastic article in The Nation about it last January. And John's there at the premiere and in a phone conversation. Now, the movie started an hour ago. John's in the theater. And like Elvis, he hasn't left. And we're waiting to see if we can get him on the phone and talk about the turnout and see what's going on in Philadelphia today. Maybe Lindorf, he's busy. I mean, there's supposed to be a Q&A afterwards. I don't know if Mr. Grant's going to attend it. But we'll find out one way or the other. In the meantime, I'll hoof it and see what's going on. You know what I mean? Here is, you know, war is the central thing with us at TCBH, and I've tempted to play some old stuff, but here, this is an interesting conversation with a guy named Jeffrey Sachs. He's talking about the Ukraine-Russia war, and I'll get back with you in a while. It'll be about 20 minutes.
Well, Politico is reporting the Biden administration is preparing to ask Congress to approve a new $1.1 billion arms sale to Taiwan. The package reportedly includes 60 anti-ship missiles, 100 air-to-air missiles. This comes after two U.S. warships sailed through the... This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to the war in Ukraine. Air raid sirens were heard across parts of Ukraine today as Russia launched a fourth day of missile strikes targeting multiple Ukrainian cities and towns. Many of the strikes have targeted Ukraine's electricity system, leaving many areas without power. Ukrainian officials said some of the Russian attacks near Kyiv were carried out by Iranian-made drones. This comes as Western leaders are vowing to provide more arms to Ukraine as well as new air defense systems. Russia escalated its attack on Ukraine after a massive explosion Saturday damaged a key bridge connecting Russia to occupied Crimea. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the General Assembly has voted 143-5 to condemn Russia's annexation of four territories seized from Ukraine. The four countries joining Russia were Belarus, Nicaragua, North Korea, and Syria. This is Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations.
The United Nations will not tolerate attempts at illegal annexation. We will never recognize it. These United Nations will not tolerate seizing a neighbor's land by force. We will stand up to it. These United Nations will not tolerate the destruction of the UN Charter.
35 nations, including China and India, abstained from the UN vote condemning Russia's annexation. This is Jean Shuang, China's deputy UN ambassador.
We have always believed that any action taken by the General Assembly should be conducive to the de-escalation of the situation, should be conducive to the early resumption of dialogue, and should be conducive to the promotion of a political solution to this crisis. The draft resolution submitted to this emergency special session for voting will not help achieve the above-mentioned objectives. Therefore, the Chinese delegation will abstain.
To talk more about the war in Ukraine, we're joined by two guests. Arshak Makishan is an exiled Russian anti-war, human rights, and climate activist. We spoke to him in Moscow just before he fled Russia in March, now based in Berlin, the Russian government currently trying to revoke his Russian citizenship. We're also joined by Hanna Perakhoda. She is a Ukrainian PhD student in history at University of Lausanne in Switzerland. She's a member of the European Network for Solidarity with Ukraine, born and raised in Donetsk, eastern Ukraine, and speaks both Russian and Ukrainian. Hanna, let's begin with you. You were in Moscow doing your academic studies right before Russia invaded Ukraine, and you grew up in Donetsk, in the occupied region of Ukraine, where this vote just took place that the vast majority of countries in the world just condemned at the United Nations. Can you talk about the significance of both? What was it like to grow up there? What do you understand about that vote and to be in Russia right before the invasion?
Okay. Thanks for having me. Well, it's a little bit difficult question, but yes, being a Ukrainian born in Donetsk and having all my family in Donetsk, actually the war started for me not this year, but 8 years ago. And me, my circle of friends and my family were affected by the war when the Russia started in 2014. And being in Moscow just before, I was there for my academic research. And my academic research is in a big, big part of it is about the Russian imperial and national ideology. So being a historian and working on Russian contemporary imperialism and also in a Russian imperialism in historic perspective, I was kind of more prepared, I think, for the invasion than most of the people who were kind of very surprised by it.
Hannah, you've talked about some of the reasons that you think Putin launched an invasion of this scale. And you've also argued that we need to take into account the national and imperial dimensions of the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, and that the resistance that the Ukrainians are putting up is most analogous to anti-colonial struggles. Could you elaborate on that and explain the reasons that you think Russia launched this invasion?
Well, yes. For me, one of the dimensions of Russian contemporary imperialist ideology is that it is driven by the resentment of a fallen empire and, what is important, by a resentment of a nationalizing empire. Actually, the national narrative, Ukraine, and that of Russia are in kind of in a total contradiction in this sense. Ukraine as a political community can only survive outside of Russia because Russia denies its right to exist, while for Russian nationalist elites, their nation is incomplete, if not impossible, without Ukraine within it. So these two narratives are kind of mutually exclusive, and this kind of nationalizing empires like Russia, today's Russia, are very dangerous, because in the current Russian perspective, Ukrainians must recognize that they are Russians, otherwise they must be destroyed. And this is not a marginal discourse, this is something you hear every day on the Russian state TV channels. So yeah, it's a state that invades another independent state, protagonizes war crimes at a huge scale, and at the same time holds a discourse and practices that can be qualified as an incitation to genocide, because there are, for example, numerous cases when children are separated from their Ukrainian families, sent to Russia, and adopted there. But I want to emphasize that, of course, history is important, but it cannot fully explain the reasons of this invasion, because history is a source of discourses and practices, but in order to influence the reality, these discourses must evade it. And the invasion of Ukraine is not some kind of historical inertia. The ideology of Putin is a product of, you know, past two centuries, but Putin's political regime that reactivates these ideas is a product of the past, like 30, 20 years.
Arshak Makishyan, you fled Russia earlier this year, very soon after the invasion. Could you explain why you left and what the state of opposition to this war in Russia now is? And respond to what Hannah said.
Before this war, we were living in an authoritarian regime. I was doing activism in Russia. I was protesting. But after this war, yeah, we were trying to organize protests. We were protesting every day, every weekend. But now Russia is not an authoritarian regime. It's a dictatorship. And our instruments, peaceful protests, they are not working anymore in Russia. So we were thinking to go somewhere to think what to do next. And yeah, now you cannot have a revolution in Russia just with peaceful protest, and propaganda in Russia is working very well, and they are using a lot of money from Europe, a lot of money from the world that are coming from fossil fuels, and now they're earning more money than before the war on fossil fuels, and they are using this money to manipulate with people's opinions. They are using this money to continue this war. So yeah, peaceful protests, they are not working anymore in Russia. So I think I can be more effective using my social media, using my voice to speak up against the war when I am not in prison or not tortured like many of my friends are being now, who are still in Russia. So it was a more strategic decision. It was not because I am afraid. Yeah, it's not about being afraid, because we want to be effective, and Russian civil society needs a representation, because Russia will have a future, and Russian people want to have a place in the future. Otherwise, Russian propaganda is using it against Ukraine. It's using to mobilize people for the war. But I think the Russian people, they are not supporting the war. They do not want to die for Putin's ambitions, for Putin's imperialistic ambitions. And they want their normal lives back. And so I'm trying to raise my voice. I'm trying to represent Russian civil society. Yes, Putin is a terrorist. This war was a terrible thing. Russian state is a terrorist state. I agree with that. But we need to think for solutions. And, of course, negotiations with Putin is not a solution. It's wrong to have negotiations with people like them. But we need to start a dialogue with Russian civil society, because Russian civil society is part of solutions. We do understand that imperialism is bad. We do understand that fascism is bad. And we are trying to oppose Putin. We're trying to create ways to oppose him. And there is anti-war movement in Russia, and they deserve every kind of help that is possible. And we need to talk about it, I think.
I wanted to ask Hanna Perahoda, as you speak to us from Switzerland, again, born and raised in Donbass, so studied in Moscow just before the invasion. You talk about in order for conditions of peace to be achieved, Russia's got to withdraw from Ukraine. You also advocate the dissolution not only of NATO, but also the Russian-dominated military alliance. Can you talk about this and how your anti-imperialist views have changed or not through this invasion and occupation by Russia of Ukraine?
Okay. Well, this is a very complex question, and I think I would go in the same, more or less the same direction as the previous speaker. I think there is a kind of my position on imperialism was provoked, and my thinking about it was provoked by a stereotype. Which I heard a lot in the Western countries, in the left milieus, a stereotype that says that this war started because Putin was scared by NATO, or because he was humiliated by the West. In my opinion, it's quite the opposite. He started the war when NATO was weak, and he felt like everybody would let him do it, because it was always the case until now. He knows that the rich countries dependent on fossil fuels, on oil and gas, that these countries continued actually to trade with him for years when he was already killing Chechens or Syrians, and even when he started a war in Ukraine 8 years ago, nothing changed fundamentally. So yes, I agree with my previous speaker, and it's something that I want to emphasize and, every time I speak or write on this issue. The key word for me is impunity and economic cynicism of the global north, of the rich northern countries and western countries. And I think when we talk about this war, we tend to overestimate the extent to which the behavior of Russian elites is motivated by real security concerns. Yes, their attack on Ukraine is basically an attempt to preserve the security, but it is not the security of Russia that they preserve. They are preserving the security of their political regime. And to ignore the difference between the two means that we forget that Russia is not Putin. And I want to say the same thing that the previous speaker, that it is Russia, it's Russian ordinary people, and their interests are exactly on the opposite to the interest of Putin and his mafia. So, I mean, if we disregard Russian internal politics, the relations between the ruling classes and society of this country, if we adopt this kind of a geopolitical perspective, which I had also before, we won't be able to understand anything about this war. And I think this war showed me and showed a lot of people around me that it is not so much about Ukraine, it's about Russian internal relationship between elites and people. It's about Russian predatory elites trying to preserve their regime, the regime that allowed them to plunder Russia in total impunity for years. And yeah, Putin's regime needed a real war because he thought it would stabilize his crumbling power. So for me, the changement in this perception and how to think about the imperialism is to be able to understand what are the internal reasons, what is happening inside of Russia. Because if we adopt just a geopolitical perspective, it is in a very easy and lazy way to analyze the world, and it doesn't work.
Aisha, could you respond to what Hannah said? In particular, the feelings of and perceptions of ordinary Russians vis-a-vis the Putin regime. You've also talked about the mass mobilization, the conscription that's taking place now of Russians. Hundreds of thousands of them have fled, and many who've spoken to the media, though they've not revealed their names out of fear for their safety as well as the safety of their families still in Russia. They've said things like, how can I take part in a war without a wish to win the war? This is a war of the Russian government, not of the Russian people, and so on, comments like this. So your sense of what ordinary Russians are feeling now and their sense of the Putin regime?
Russian ordinary people are feeling horror because they are left alone with dictatorship. They are left alone with millions of police, and this police is financed by Europe, by fossil fuel money. So we need to help them to escape the war, because it's very strange for me when European countries are shutting down the borders for people who are trying to escape from mobilization, because if these people would be able to escape the mobilization, then they won't be taking part in the war. Of course, yeah, they can be more brave and fight Putin by bare hands, but it's not possible to fight a police state. Putin has millions of police, and it's not easy to have a revolution. You cannot go just to Kremlin with your bare hands and have a revolution. It's not so easy to have a revolution in dictatorship where all media are controlled by government, where all independent media were declared foreign agents.
Arshak,
and had
we have
to
10
flee.
Seconds.
So, yeah.
We have 10 seconds, Arshak.
Yeah?
If you could finish your statement.
Yes. So Russian people, they don't support the war. They are afraid to oppose the war, I think.
Well, Arshak Makhijan, we want to thank you for being with us again. Your own citizenship in Russia is threatened to be revoked. Exiled Russian anti-war human rights activists in Berlin, and Hannah Perekhoda. I want to thank you for joining us from Lausanne. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
Yeah, that's right. It's not so easy to have a revolution in a police state. I'm sure the Proud Boys are learning that now, and all the crazy guys and gals who stormed the Capitol building. Although, actually, their sentences, the jail time they're getting is actually very, very lenient, if you ask me. I mean, they're not really going down for any hard time for a very long time. I'm going to take you back to several years ago when Dave Lindorf, the guy at thiscan'tbehappening.net, who we're sort of waiting on here in this hour. We may not have time. The movie is airing in Philadelphia right now. A Compassionate Spy is the name of the movie. But this is an article that Lindorf and another guy in the appeared on FAIR. The article appeared in The Nation several years ago. It was around December of 2018. And it was such a controversial article that it ricocheted all over the place. Some people, journalists, stole the facts that he and his buddy dug up about the Pentagon, speaking of a police state. And by the way, most Americans are too stupid to, I don't know, I mean, ignorant, maybe a lot of them are ignorant. A lot of us are ignorant. The article details the failure of the Pentagon as mandated by Congress to audit where they spend the money and where does it go. And they failed the audit. It was amazing. It was an amazing article. Here we go. It's about 20 minutes, and I'll still keep trying to get a hold of the This Can't Be Happening gang at the movie premiere and see if any of them have anything to say. I'm sure next Tuesday we'll have a earful about how the movie went. And it was in Vienna, by the way. It's been all around the Western world right now. In Colorado, Telluride, at a film festival. And Vienna at a film festival. And it was in Cambridge, the centerpiece of where the movie takes place. It's a documentary. But anyhow, here's where our money goes. As much as 49 to 51% of your tax dollars. They can't even count it.
For those of us who remember the $640 toilet seat, the unbelievable absurdity of Pentagon spending has long been, while unbelievably absurd, taken for granted. The Department of Defense spends billions and billions on we know not what year after year. Tra-la. Elite media reported that Congress passed a $700 billion Pentagon bill, more than Trump even asked for, and that was a blip, unchallenged. Although the same press corps, faced with a proposal for health care, see themselves in the business of grilling proponents on how on earth they would pay for it. Pentagon spending is untethered, unaccountable. And no one complains too loudly because national security, magic words that shut down any critical conversation. But, you know, things are changing and people are reviving questions that have been shrugged or laughed off, like, why can't we know what the Defense Department is doing with what, if it were a matter of a few dollars for food stamps, would be importantly described as our taxpayer dollars? Our next guest has been examining that set of questions, resulting in an exclusive for The Nation magazine. The story is called The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed, How U.S. Military Spending Keeps Rising Even as the Pentagon Flunks Its Audit. He's called Dave Lindorf, longtime investigative reporter and author. He also writes for Salon, the London Review of Books, and Tarbell.org. Sometimes for fair.org as well. He joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dave Lindorf.
Hi, Janine. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, actually, you know, this story, I first got on this story for an article for Fair back in 2016 when I saw a number in the alternative press about the $6.5 trillion expenditures in the Army budget of that year's Pentagon budget, which was only about $500 billion. And I thought, whoa, what's that? And then I started wondering why it wasn't in any of the mainstream media. So I did a little exploring as to what it was in the article. But the main point of the article was that it just wasn't being reported in the corporate media.
Well, and I'd like to hear some more history on that because I'm reading about the Pentagon's first audit. And that doesn't, how can that be true?
Well, you know, in 1990, the Congress passed a bill called the CFO Act, which said that every federal agency had to have an auditable budget and had to submit to annual audits from outside auditors. And by, you know, somewhere around 2014, every agency in the government did, in fact,
have auditable budgets and was being audited externally annually, except for the Pentagon, which has steadfastly stonewalled against even making its budget auditable or even comprehensible. And finally, after years and years of this stonewalling, which was called out as stonewalling, by the way, by Chuck Grassley, senator from Iowa, he actually said in a hearing last year that he told the controller for the Pentagon that he was pretty much of a mind that they must at this point not want to be audited and be deliberately stalling, which I agree is true. So anyway, the Congress came up with last year $900 million to fund an audit, whether the Pentagon wanted it or not. And so for the past year, 1,200 outside auditors headed by Ernst & Young went over all the books. And on November 15th, they reported that they couldn't do it. The numbers were so screwy and impenetrable that they couldn't audit the Pentagon. Undersecretary Patrick Shanahan came out to the press and said, we had an audit, we failed it, and we thought we would fail it. And then he said, but we should get a lot of credit because we even attempted it. Well, the media reported that and his words saying they should get praised for what they did. And none of them bothered to point out that they'd been stonewalling for 26 years, so they don't get any credit at all.
Yeah, they almost made it sound as though, yeah, you know, they're right. It really is complicated, you know,
right.
As though that somehow excused it. Well, I mean, we can come back to media, although media certainly thread throughout this story. But in terms of the research that you did and that you were able to hook into, what did you uncover when you yourself went through that audit and talked to folks?
I started out with the numbers that were found last fall in a report by this professor from Michigan State University, Mark Skidmore, and two of his graduate students. They looked at all the reports of parts of the Pentagon budget done by the Pentagon's Office of Inspector General over a period from 1998 to 2015. That's an internal auditor monitor of the Pentagon. Every federal agency has an Office of Inspector General. And what they did was they would look at a part of the budget, like maybe one year it was the Marine budget, one year it was the Navy budget, one year it was the Air Force budget, one year it was the Army budget, and then they cycle around and they do other parts too of the Pentagon budget. But they never do the whole thing. And just those parts had these screwy numbers that were called plugs in Pentagon jargon, I found out. And they plugged these numbers in ostensibly to make things balance out or something. But the numbers are really screwy. They're like in the sometimes in the trillions of dollars. And there's never been a Pentagon budget more than, I think, the highest it ever was at the height of the Iraq War was $800 billion, so not $1 trillion. And they had ones that were as high as $6.5 trillion, $11 trillion. You know, really crazy numbers. And the total for over that period that they added up was $21 trillion, which is as much as the whole entire U.S. debt in the history of the country.
And that's money that's just, it goes in but doesn't come out? You kind of can't trace it? What do you mean when you say there's trillions of dollars and yet the budget is only billions of dollars?
Well, as Mark Skidmore points out, we don't know what the hell it is because there's no explanation for the numbers in any of the Inspector General's accounts. They just say these numbers aren't supported by ledger entries, and they say this has to be corrected or you can't do this again. And then, of course, they do it again the next year. But it makes the budgets unreadable and meaningless. So we don't know whether those are real entries for real money that's coming in and it's money going in and out. It's positive. It's on the positive side and the negative side, the assets and liabilities. So you don't know whether these are real, like, secret money coming in that's not appropriated by Congress, although I tend to doubt it. Some of it might be. Mark Skidmore says, we don't know. He says maybe it is real money being printed by the Fed or something, or maybe some of it is real money that's being slipped to them from some other source. Or maybe what I think it is and what my sources in this story say is that the numbers are made up and they're meant to make the budgets unreadable by anybody and unauditable. Chuck Spinney, the whistleblower from the famous in the 80s for really exposing Pentagon corruption and fraud, said that he thinks the goal is to paralyze Congress and paralyze the media, not to be able to ask questions about the Pentagon budget because you can't understand it.
Well, let me just put a pin in the fact you just named Chuck Spinney. He's one of the sources that you rely on. You're not talking to folks who are kind of just making random guesses. Your sources in this story are folks who are insiders who are close to this kind of accounting, and they're folks who are going on the record. And they're saying that a lot of money, its source and its destination, is just not available. And at a certain point, it starts to look less like, you know, accidentally sloppy bookkeeping and an actual, I mean, forgive me if I'm underscoring this too hard, but an actual intent to avoid accountability on the Pentagon's part.
Yeah, I think that, and that's my conclusion from the sources I talked to. Jack Armstrong, who was for 5 or 6 years the supervising director of audits at the Office of Inspector General, so really central to this, Armstrong said when they present their financial reports to Congress for the current year and for the prior year's documents, they should be telling Congress these reports are all garbage. And that's important. I mean, we're talking about $717 billion, which is 54% of the discretionary budget for the federal government. It's 54% of the taxes that every American pays to the federal government is being totally unaccounted for and is going to Congress in the form of garbage when they have to look and see what was done with the money that was allocated in the prior years. And the worst part about it is that that's being used to justify the next year's appropriation for the next fiscal year. So I just think if this were happening in the Department of Health and Human Services or in the EPA or the Department of Labor or the Department of Education, there would be calls for hearings, subpoenaing of secretaries under oath. There'd be Justice Department investigations, and there would also be investigative reporting by the mainstream media, but nothing about the Pentagon when this is happening.
Absolutely.
It's just mind-boggling to me.
It's mind-boggling to me as well, and I wanted to move you on to media because, you know, I read through the coverage, the New York Times in their editorial where they say, you know, quote, defense leaders have had less exacting standards, close quote. You know, I guess we're supposed to find that damning in its mildness or something, you know. But for the for the New York Times, the problem is, quote, the inability to accurately track how money is spent makes it impossible to know whether precious resources are going to the right places, undermining the Pentagon's ability to be successful in its far-flung missions around the globe, close quote. In other words, not about our precious resources not going to places like feeding hungry people, housing homeless people, healthcare to keep people alive. You know, it's not about the, even when they come to provide context, it's not a context about the government's ability to meet the needs of the people. It's as if the problem with the Pentagon spending too much unaccountably means that the Pentagon might run out of money that they can spend unaccountably, you know, that the context.
They won't be able to do the Imperial Project properly.
Exactly.
Without being able to know how to spend the money.
Exactly.
Well, I think they know how they spend the money. I think they just don't want us to know and the press to know, and they don't even want Congress to know. They're in violation of the Constitution. They aren't reporting to Congress as required. They aren't returning money that isn't spent as required by Article 1 in the Constitution. So, I mean, this is really serious stuff, and nobody in Congress is calling them on it. nobody's talking about the fakery in the books. And, you know, the Pentagon's excuse for years has been, well, we have these legacy systems, you see, and they don't talk to each other, and we can't tell what's going on because of that. But this has been 26 years that they have been saying it's our legacy systems. And believe me, back when I was using a K-Pro computer 26 years ago, they have the money to have long ago bought, you know, I don't know, 5 or 6 Watson computers and have the whole thing taken care of. The idea that they would say we still have legacy systems after 26 years of saying we have legacy systems is laughable.
It doesn't pass the laugh test. Well, I pulled you off it earlier, but I did want to ask what your response was to corporate media haymaking over Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in a tweet, who made reference to the $21 trillion that we're talking about that's unaccounted for, and, you know, made a mistake in suggesting that that was existing funds that might be turned to something else. But as a reaction to this information, I just wondered what you made of that kerfuffle.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. She picked up on the story, and she tweeted out that there was $21 trillion in missing funds at the Pentagon, and that she noted that that would be 2/3 of what people are saying it would cost over 10 years to have Medicare for all. Her point is valid to a point in, you know, she's right about the amount. She was wrong about saying that it is missing money. It's not a pot of money, although Mark Skidmore says we don't know what it is, and it might be a lot of missing money, but we don't know that. And that's where she got caught being in error. I would have given her maybe one Pinocchio instead of 4 that the Washington Post fact check column gave her, because she did get the $21 trillion right, and it is a huge amount of unaccountable funding that the Pentagon is putting in its books. But I give her a lot of credit for getting the $21 trillion reported on in the Washington Post, which has studiously avoided any mention of the stunning report that Mark Skidmore did last fall. None of the mass media has reported on that. So this is the first mention. And, you know, as an aside, I want to thank Ocasio-Cortez for the fact-checking, which has said that our article is correct and that Skidmore's study is correct. So the question is, why haven't they reported on them? And also, why is it that after this Nation article has come out and is being seen as well-reported and correct, nobody from the mainstream media has contacted us and asked for an interview?
Which says a lot.
Unless you call NPR mainstream media, you know, that's semi-alternative. And then the rest are Pacifica stations and various independent stations, but no mainstream media.
Well, at FAIR, we oftentimes think about back in the late 80s when the New York Times' Keith Schneider was asked why the big papers were shying away from reporting the story of Iran-Contra. And he said, this story can shatter a republic. You know, I think it's so damaging and the implications are so extraordinary that for us to run the story, it had better be based on the most solid evidence we can amass, which essentially meant there is no amount of evidence that will be big enough. So in a way, the Defense Department defines too big to fail. And in some sense, for corporate media, the story's too big to tell.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned Iran-Contra, because one of the things that Chuck Spinney told me was that what we were learning is that one of the main reasons for these plugs in the budget is to allow the Pentagon to come into Congress and say, look, we spent all the money you gave us last year, we need more, when in fact they probably are not spending all the money they get each year. And then the money that doesn't get spent, which by law is supposed to be returned to the Treasury, gets what they have a term for it. It gets nippered away from the category it was in and moved to 5-year money in other parts of the budget, where it gets hidden away and becomes a slush fund that the Pentagon can use for black projects and other things that it wants to use it for without any observation. And when he mentioned that possibility, and other people had mentioned it, Chuck said that this actually happened before in the 80s and was exposed by him and other whistleblowers. And what they had done back then was overstated the amount of inflation when they were asking for their next year's budget. You might remember that was a high inflation period, but it never got over 10%, even for a brief period of time. They were slapping on 30% adjustments for inflation in their budget requests. And then when it didn't get spent, they would shunt it over to something called a merged surplus account, which was black money. And Spinney said that he and his whistleblowing colleagues think a bunch of it went to fund Iran-Contra. The total of it was something around the order of $60 to $100 billion in that merged surplus account. And when Weinberger was called into Congress, when they used to do real investigations, and asked where the money went, he said, "I don't know."
Well, finally, we know we need to shift something in media where they recognize that, first of all, Pentagon numbers, we don't just think in terms of trillions and billions. They have to be contextualized. They have to be put in terms of priorities. What else could we be doing with that money, you know, that we often hear we can't afford to do? But then on a more fundamental level, I think something in the media and also in the public needs to shift where we recognize that we have a right to know this information.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things about this story that I got right at the end is that this body called the Financial Accounting Advisory Board, which sets the rules for federal accounting, approved a guideline that they had proposed in the summer and went through a 90-day comment period. And that guideline says now, effective October 4th and effective for the 2018 year that was being audited at the Pentagon, they said, if you have classified budgets, you can fake the numbers in those budgets and you can move some things you're funding out of the classified area into some other area where it won't be discovered. So basically, the new guidelines of the FASAB are basically legitimizing what the Pentagon's been doing for the last 26 years of making up numbers and hiding parts of their budget from any oversight. So unless something is done about that by Congress, unless they raise holy hell and say, no, you can't do that, that's going to be the norm.
All right, then. Well, there's lots more we can talk on, and I think we will, but we'll end it there for now. We've been speaking with reporter Dave Lindorf, among other things, a founding member of the online newspaper collective ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. You can find his expose on Pentagon accounting fraud exclusively at TheNation.com. Dave Lindorf, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that was 2018 on FAIR, our favorite news program for news behind the headlines at Counterspin. That's F-A-I-R, FAIR, FAIR.org. We run it a few days late every Tuesday in the first hour before John Grant comes out. We're obviously having trouble getting a hold of John Grant in the theater in Philadelphia, watching the movie co-produced by Dave Lindorf called A Compassionate Spy. And I can't wait to get a watch of it myself later. There is a book coming out in the near future, solely authored by Lindorf, called Spy Without a Country. And that's the tentative title. I've seen the covers. It's in pre-press work, and I'll be happy to get you a copy if you want to order it through here once it comes out. I'm really happy to have it on. And we'll kill the show a little early today, but first some wild music. Here's Matt Grimm out of Nebraska. Red Smear is the name of it.
So you wear the best mental, you've gotten bigger too. Thankful by seagulls and dad by Christian Disney. You give us empty words and flags to rally down, but the rest of it don't seem to trickle down. To streets of hopeless faces, markets and foreclosed. Downsized part-time jobs, forsaken by the HMOs.
sucking up the welfare when there's war to subsidize. And it won't just go away if you hit me. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cap right in their brain. Ain't no room in this utopia for evidence it ain't. Arm the bases, arm the soccer moms. Declare your holy war. Before the meek claim our inheritance, you'd better kill the poor. Ship out jobs to lands of desolate and despair. With purpose, livelihoods for mirrors, pennies on the tear. They ask for more, refer them to the grain parades. There's always room for more in the mass grave. Repave our cities, there's consumerist plantations. Turn the caps into a martial force of occupation. All of America, pristine and sterilized. Woe to those who can't afford the price. Kill the poor, kill the poor. Put a cap right in their brain. Ain't no room in this utopia for evidence it ain't. On the pages, I'm a soccer mom. Declare you hold it.
That's your answer to everything. Tattoo it on your forehead. Your revolution is over, Mr. Lebowski. Condolences. The bomb's lost. My advice to you is to do what your parents did. Get a job, sir. The bombs will always lose. Do you hear me, Lebowski? The bombs will always lose.
How was your meeting, Mr. Lebowski?
Okay. The old man told me to take any rug in the house.
Run away from this thing. Go!
Is this your only ID?
You know my rights, man.
You don't know shit, Lebowski.
I want a fucking lawyer, man. I want Bill Kunstler, man, or Ron Kuby.
Mr. Treehorn tells us that he had to eject you from his garden party, that you were drunk and abusive.
Mr. Treehorn treats objects like women, man.
Mr. Treehorn draws a lot of water in this town. You don't draw shit, Lebowski. Now, we got a nice, quiet little beach community here, and I aim to keep it nice and quiet. So let me make something play. I don't like you sucking around bothering our citizens, Lebowski. I don't like your jerk-off name. I don't like your jerk-off face. I don't like your jerk-off behavior. And I don't like you, jerk-off. Do I make myself clear? I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Ow! Fucking fascist! Get out of Malibu, Lebowski! Ow! Get out of Malibu! Get beat!
Keep your ugly fucking gold brickin' ass out of my beach community.
Woo! I'm having a good night. You guys are dead in the water.
You're a Grand Old Rag, sung by Billy Murray, Edison Records.
Feeling comes a ceiling and it sets my brain a reeling when I'm listening to the music of a military band. Any tune like Yankee Doodle simply sets me off my noodle. It's a patriotic something that no one can understand. Way down south in the land of cotton, melody untiring, ain't that inspiring? Hurrah, hurrah, we'll join the jubilee, and that's going some for the Yankees by gum. Red, white, and blue, I am for you. Honest, you're a grand old rag. You're a grand old rag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old rag. You're a grand old rag, you're a high-flying flag, and forever in peace may you wave. You're the emblem of the land I love, the home of the free and the brave. Every heart beats true under red, white, and blue, where there's never a boast or brag. But should old acquaintance be forgot, keep your eye on the grand old rag.
Log Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without you being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.